Well, let me interrupt your conversations and add my welcome to David's at the start. My name is Rupert Standry. I'm the vicar here at St. Peter's. It's great to be able to welcome you here this morning, particularly if you're here for the first time, particularly if you've been invited along for the first of our What Do You Want Most services over the next, this Sunday and the next, and looking today at the theme of happiness. If you grab hold of your order of service, you can see up next is an interview with David Tubbs. So I'm going to invite David to come up and join me up here on the stage.
I'm going to use this microphone. This seems to be working without too many problems. David, thank you very much for being willing to be interviewed this morning.
Thanks, Ruth.
The theme is happiness, and you are on staff here as our music director, so you must be just an insanely happy person. Is that right, and is that why I'm interviewing you?
Yeah, that would be great, wouldn't it? No, so I'm depressed for the last year or so, a little bit more. I've been struggling with depression and anxiety, and I've probably been depressed for a lot longer than that without realizing it, in a sort of mild way, but in a sort of intense, acute way, it's been the last year or so. And I guess that kind of manifests itself in kind of low mood, very low mood, kind of being numb to happiness, only focusing on the negative, inability to face the day or face work or face social situations or engage in family life, some panic attacks, severe kind of stress and anxiety. And then leading up to time off work because I just wasn't coping. And I'm still at reduced hours now. And throughout that, taking medication as well.
Okay. So just off the bat, happiness seems somewhat elusive to you. And yet, when we did our survey on the doors, it was by miles, you know, the thing that people were wanting. Do you think it's because actually happiness is something that's elusive to many of us?
Yeah, well, that seems to be the case for me. But I've been thinking a bit about this, and the stats say that a quarter of us in the UK in any given year would be facing some sort of mental health difficulties. So I guess, I don't know how many there are here, maybe 30 of us here this morning will be depressed or something similar. That's quite a lot of us. Yeah. And then I guess on top of that, there'll just be people that are sad, just sad. Okay. Not depressed, but sad. So, yeah, maybe it seems to be elusive, yeah.
So, David, what about you? Does your depression mean that you can't be happy? I mean, you're a Christian.
Yeah.
Aren't Christians supposed to be happy? Sort of in a slightly unreal and annoying kind of a way. What about you?
Yeah, the sort of happy, clappy Christian, yeah. To some extent, yes, I guess it does mean that I can't be happy to that in that way. I have been making really good steps towards recovery. I've had lots of help from lots of people, including the NHS. But to some guarantee, there's no guarantee that I'll ever return back to the way I was before all this, to complete full health. And whilst I'm ill, it really depends on the day. Some days are good days, and some days are bad days. One thing that's encouraging to me as a Christian is that I feel like I'm free to not be happy all the time. Yeah. So I don't have to be happy all the time, which is kind of weirdly comforting.
So just let me jump in there. What difference, therefore, would you say being a Christian makes to you, David, being happy?
For me, I find a huge encouragement in reading the Bible. The Bible speaks a lot about the hard times. There's a lot of characters in the Bible that, I guess, looking back on them now, we might say they're probably depressed. And it's encouraging to kind of see their response and what they do with that. And instead of kind of pursuing a kind of surface level happiness, that they're looking for something a bit deeper, looking for contentment. And they turn to God, kind of turn to who he is, what he's done, what he's like, his character. And by doing that, by turning to him instead of their situation, they learn this kind of deeper contentment with life, learning to trust him rather than their experiences and their emotions. And I've found that to be true for myself. That turning to God and trusting him has led to a kind of not a surface level happiness as such, but a deeper contentment. Which, if I follow the pattern of the guys in the Bible, that in time leads to joy. I'm still working on that bit.
Okay. But you're on the way there.
Yeah.
So a deep level contentment. What else would you say?
Yeah.
What other ways would you say being a Christian has made to you being happy?
So for me, I guess I've got a future hope. So it could be that I never fully recover, or it could be that I get much much worse. But I guess I've got this this hope that God's promised that one day I'll be with him in heaven. And there won't be any illness, any physical illness or any mental illness. So I've got that future to look forward to, even if it gets worse now. The NHS, when you go for one of the sessions with them, that they've been really brilliant. Every time they ask you whether you've had any thoughts or feelings about wanting to hurt yourself or end your life, which is great that they ask that, because it's such a common experience for many people with depression. But I've always been able to answer truthfully that, well, no, I haven't had any of those feelings or thoughts. And they've often been surprised and said, why do you think that is? Why do you think you've never had those thoughts of wanting to end your life? And I guess the answer is because I have that hope. That future hope that one day I will be without this in heaven, and because I have that trust in a God who his character is steadfast, is secure, I can turn to him in and through this.
So, happiness for a Christian with depression, it maybe looks very different to what we might think of as happiness,
but
you would say, nevertheless, it's very real, and actually, it makes all the difference being a Christian in your life.
Yeah.
Great. David, thank you very much for being willing to come up and speak openly and honestly. Why don't we just show our appreciation to David for that? Thank you.
We're now going to hear from the Bible. Sophia has our reading for us this week. She'll tell us where to find it in the church Bibles before reading it for us. Sophia.
Our Bible reading can be found on page 1049, Luke 15, 11 to 32. The parable of the lost son. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed the pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the elder son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of his servants and asked him, What was going on? Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The elder brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never gave me even a goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead, and he is alive again. He was lost and is found.
Sophia, thank you very much for that reading. Do keep your Bibles open on page 1049. And if you open up your order of service, you can see just on the inside page there, there's the very briefest of outlines as we look together at this part of the Bible. You should also have found on your seat as you came to sit down a little slip that looks like this, and maybe even a pen next to it or nearby. And that's really, if anyone has got any questions or comments that occurs to them during the talk and they would like to ask that, you'll see from the order of service, there's a Q&A after this. So we'll gather those questions in and have an answer on those. So let me encourage you, as you're listening away, to jot down any questions that you get. Well, as we heard earlier, happiness is and was by miles the top answer we had to our door-to-door survey in the local area. It's what the people of Fulham most want in life. And to help us get in the mood to consider this topic of happiness, I want us to watch a classic video on a song all about happiness. Let's have a look at that.
Here's a little song I wrote. You might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy. In every life we have some trouble, but when you worry you make it double. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry, be happy now. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry, be happy. Ain't got no place to lay your head. Somebody came and took your bed. Don't worry. Be happy. The landlord say your rent is late. He may have to litigate. Don't worry.
Be happy. Look at me, I'm happy.
I think it'd be fair to say pop videos have come a long way in the last 25 years. But there's Bobby McFerrin's classic, Don't Worry, Be Happy. If you lose all your money on the stock market crash, if you can't pay the rent, you've got nowhere to sleep, don't worry, be happy. But I guess if it was as easy as that, then well over 200 people, when we asked them what they most want in life, would not have said happiness, because they could have just been happy. But it isn't as easy as that. Happiness is what we all want, but what we find so elusive. In 2007, the then Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, himself, not the happiest man in the world, appointed this man to be the government's happiness czar. Robert Layard was given the responsibility of being able to make us all happy, and he certainly looked like quite a cheerful fellow, but I'm not sure how successful his appointment was. There's certainly no happiness czar in the current government. And I don't know if you saw the story in the news this week. Pop singer Selena Gomez has broken up with Justin Bieber again. A source said Selena started seeing the bigger picture when it came to their relationship. Like, what was more important, her happiness or being with Justin? She obviously chose happiness and is so thrilled with her decision-making process. Well, tell it like it is, Selena. She obviously knows both what happiness is and how to get it. It's breaking up with Justin Bieber. But that doesn't really help the rest of us who aren't in a relationship with Justin Bieber. So instead, what I want us to do is turn to the reading from the Bible that Sophia read for us. It's a story that Jesus told about two sons. In our Bibles, it's got the heading, The Parable of the Lost Son. But you will have noticed, as you heard it read, that there are actually two sons in the story, not just one. And that's important for us today, because each of the sons in the story represents a different approach to life, or if you like, a different way of pursuing and seeking happiness in life. The younger son, quite clearly, he has a sort of eat, drink, and be merry approach to finding happiness. He's got a YOLO, you're only young once approach. You might even say a hedonistic approach to looking for happiness, maximizing pleasure while you can get it. His older brother, by contrast, is the dutiful eldest child. His approach to life is do the right thing. Keep the rules. Obey father. So he's actually almost at the other end of the scale. He's looking for happiness by putting family first, making sacrifices for family, by being good and doing good. That's how he's going after happiness. And Jesus told this story about these two very different sons to explore those and actually to expose not just one, but both of those approaches to life, to see the shortcomings of both of them, and also to help us understand how we might find what eludes them, true, fulfilling happiness, how that could be ours. Now, I've put those two purposes in telling this story in the order of service. That's what we'll consider each one in turn. So first of all, then, the first reason Jesus told this story, to show us two failed pursuits of happiness. Let's start with the younger son, because I think it's easier to see it with him. Have a look back with me at verse 11 on page 1049. Jesus continued, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. Well, then, as now, in fact, you got your share of the inheritance when someone dies and not before. So what this younger son is effectively saying to his father is, Dad, I wish you were dead. I don't care about you, but what I care about is all the stuff you've got that you can give me It is a terrible way to treat your father. But more than that, in this story, it's really clear, I think, that the father represents God. And the sad thing is that that is how many people today treat God. For them, the pursuit of happiness involves taking all the good things that God gives them in life, but with no place for God himself in their lives. Well, how does that go for this younger son? Have a look at verse 13. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, all he'd been given, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. So here is his pursuit of happiness. First of all, world travel. He sets off for a distant country and no doubt takes in a few countries along the way. He maximizes his pleasure, wild living, and he has uninhibited spending. He squanders his wealth. Here is full-throttled, unrestrained hedonism with no reference whatsoever to God, to the Father who gave him all these things to enjoy. Verse 14, after he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country and he began to be in need. So he went and he hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to the fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. Now, maybe a bit of financial planning or just better luck, and this younger son would have fared a bit better. But the truth is, you don't need to lose everything in life to feel how this man comes to feel. You can have more money, more friends, more food, and a better job than feeding pigs, and feel just as lost in life and alone, and actually as hopeless as this man does. So here's the younger son. His pursuit of happiness fails, and he finds himself cut off from his father and deeply unhappy. But what about the elder brother? Is his approach any more effective? Well, we meet him for the first time towards the end of the story, and he's having a stand-up, blazing row with his father, which is not normally a sign of great happiness. Have a look at verse 28. The elder brother became angry and refused to go in to the celebration. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends." So here's someone who spent their life being dutiful, who has done the right thing. They've stayed at home, helped dad run the family business, obeyed all the orders of the CEO. Has it made him happy and fulfilled? Well, what one word does he use to describe his life in verse 29? Slaving. It's a terrible way to view his relationship with his father. Slavery. But again, it's how many people come to see and understand a relationship with God. They dutifully, in their lives, obey all of the orders that they feel God is making, like don't smoke, don't drink, go to church, say your prayers. They do all the right things, but does it make them happy being religious? No. They regard living like that as a burden. It's an obligation that is being put on them. It's a slavery that they resent rather than enjoy. See, this older son, his relationship with his father is just as broken and dysfunctional without ever going anywhere, by staying right at home, without ever doing anything wrong. Two failed pursuits of happiness. The hedonist, who so obviously in this story crashes and burns, but also, as you look at it, the moralist, who ends up resentful of having to do the right thing and just as unhappy. But exposing our failed attempts to find happiness with these two contrasting approaches to life is only part of the reason why Jesus told this story. The other thing that he wants us to know is where and how we can find happiness ourselves. So secondly, you can see just there on the outline, one guaranteed place of happiness. And again, we'll start with the younger son. We left him in the story in a pigsty, hungry, broke, and alone. And many people experience that same sense of unhappiness, even in better circumstances. But what sets this man apart is that he allows his situation in life, his experience, to help him see life more clearly. Let me say that again. What sets him apart from many other people in similar circumstances is he allows his situation to help him see his life more clearly, to see that his pursuit of happiness, how he was going after it, hasn't worked. Have a look at verse 17. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and he went to his father." See, this man, this moment in his life, came to his senses. He saw something that before he had been unable to see. He saw how unhappy he was. Now, often that is the easiest part of this. But he also came to his senses about what was the root cause of his unhappiness, and therefore what he had to do about it. And that bit is often much, much harder. And as he reflected on his circumstances, he realized that what he needed to do to be happy was to come back to his father, to say sorry for how he'd used him, treated him, and then simply just to throw himself on his father's mercy and hope for the best. Saint Augustine, one of the earliest Christian writers, he expressed the spiritual reality of that realization that this young son had when he wrote these words: "O God, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." It's what this younger son realized about his father in the story. It's what we actually need to recognize about our relationship with God in our lives. Our unhappiness comes from turning away from God. Our happiness begins when we decide to turn back to him. And look what happens when you do. Verse 20. "So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him." Jesus is telling us in this story the one place where we're guaranteed to find happiness. It is in a restored relationship with God. This is what it is like when we return to him. He loves us. He has compassion for us. He's waiting for us. He's longing for us to come back. If your relationship with God is anything like this younger son's, Jesus told this story so that you would know that this is the source of your unhappiness, but also so that you would know this is what it would be like if you were to return to him. He loves you. He has compassion for you. He's waiting for you. He's longing for you to return. It's so different, isn't it, to what we might expect if we were to return to God, to say sorry. We might expect him to reject us, not have us back. We might expect him to maybe grudgingly have us back, but make us feel ashamed, make us feel unworthy. But in fact, Jesus said it's the opposite of that. And it's so different to what we might expect that I think that the younger son doesn't even see it for what it is. His father hanging around his neck, kissing him, and he goes straight into his prepared speech, the one that he came up with in the pigsty. Have a look at verse 21. The son said to his father, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But he gets cut off halfway through the speech. His father interrupts him. But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. The son hopes for mercy. What he receives is love and forgiveness. An unexpected generosity and happiness. "Let's have a feast and celebrate," says the father. That's the younger son who comes to his senses at a moment in his life about what his life amounts to, who abandons his failed pursuit of happiness and comes back to God and discovers in doing that a happiness beyond his wildest imagination. But what about the older brother? What becomes of him? Let's have a look. Verse 25. "Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard the music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The elder brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him." At the end of the story, the older son refuses to go in to the celebration. He's angry and he's resentful, and in fact, he's more unhappy than ever before. And as with the younger son, do you notice that? The father goes out to meet him, to plead with him to come in. And so to experience for himself that same happiness of a restored relationship with him. But the story ends without him coming in. What is it that stops him? What is it that stands between him and that happiness that could be his? Well, we've actually seen it already. Have a look again at verse 29. "But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you. I've never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends.'" His duty, his morality, his doing the right thing, and the sense of entitlement and actually resentment that flows out of living like that. So many people in life fail to come in to this celebration, fail to come back to God because they feel they've never gone away, even though they have a broken relationship with him. They feel because they're decent people who've kept the rules, they've got no need of forgiveness. They've got nothing to say sorry about. And so they never do. And so they never come back or come in. And so they never discover for themselves the happiness that can come from a restored relationship with God. If that is you, if you're somewhat like the older brother, decent, moral, upright, keep the rules, nothing to say sorry about, can I plead with you, don't let your goodness keep you from God. Two failed pursuits of happiness, the hedonist and the moralist. One guaranteed place of happiness, coming back to God, to restore relationship with him. I don't know which of those, or either of those two sons, those two pursuits would maybe describe how you're living life, how you see life. I do know But until you come back to God, the happiness that you seek in life will always elude you. But when you do, it will be yours forever. I want to, just at the end of this talk, before we get to the Q&A, lead us in a prayer. The words of the prayer are going to come up on the screen. This would be a prayer, not appropriate for everyone, I imagine, here to pray. But this would be a prayer for anyone who wants to do in their life what this younger son did, and actually what the elder son failed to do, but so desperately needed to do, and that is to come back to God. If that is you, then I would invite you, as I say these words of this prayer, to echo them in your own heart. As I said, that won't be appropriate for everyone, but for some, that might be exactly how you would like to respond. So let's take a moment of quiet, give you a chance to read through the words of that prayer, and then I'll lead us in it. Let me lead us in that prayer. Heavenly Father, thank you for the story Jesus told about how to find true, lasting happiness. A story that shows us what we're like and what you're like. I'm sorry for the way I've treated you and looked for happiness apart from you, a pursuit that has failed. Thank you that everyone who comes back to you is received by you. I come back to you now, throwing myself on your mercy, not trusting in my own goodness, but confident of your forgiveness and love. Please fill my heart with joy as this day forward I seek to live my life with you as my Heavenly Father. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, if that is a prayer that you found yourself wanting to echo in your own heart, I would love to hear about that. I'd love to talk to you more about that over tea and coffee afterwards. But for now, it's an opportunity for any questions or comments that people have made. I mentioned the slips earlier. If you've got one of those to hand and if you've got a pen, just a few moments to jot down a question. The stewards in a couple of minutes will just come and collect up those questions. We'll have a short time of Q&A. Before we draw this part of our service together. If you want to pass your questions just along to the middle, and then the stewards can collect them up. Okay, fantastic. We've got heaps and heaps of questions, probably more questions than we've got time. I'm going to answer as quickly as I can, hopefully as helpfully as I can, but if you feel you've been seriously shortchanged or we didn't get to your question, do come and ask me. So here's the first one. What would Jesus say to the moderate younger brother who never comes to his senses because he's having a good time? So the guy who, with a bit of better luck and a bit of financial planning, the money doesn't run out quite and he doesn't crash and burn. I think Jesus would say, why settle for less? Why settle for less? It's a pale imitation of the real thing. And unfortunately, you won't ever discover that. I think that's what he would say. He might put it a little bit more carefully and kindly than that. Hang on. I think a doctor wrote that one. Sorry, I can't read that. Verse 31, despite the son being a moralist and not truly cherishing his father says, you are always with me, yet you say he has not been accepted by God. Yes, that's a really good question. That's exactly what the father says. My son, you are always with me. Everything I have is yours. It's a really good point. I think maybe that contradicts the fact the elder son refusing to come in. Maybe that's how the story ends. The elder son gets everything, so that's okay. I think the focus of that is everything I have is yours. All my stuff is yours, according to the sort of the rules of how this story works. But there's no relationship. the relationship is still a broken relationship. So I think it's having the stuff that God gives without having God. I think it's just a more respectable way of living life without breaking the rules, but without God. But you might think that it has a hidden, happier ending. Next question. Does God intend for us to be happy now, as well as knowing we will be in heaven? If so, what does that look like? Okay, that's a really good question. And I think the answer would be yes. I think that is a real intention, that the happiness that is in store for a human being in a restored relationship with God is not all deferred happiness. It isn't just grin and bear it now, and then on the other side of the grave, paradise. I think the testimony of many, many Christians would be that that sense of celebration and reconnection to God brings joy that begins now. It can be deflected, it can be battened down by the circumstances of life and go deep rather than surface, as David was saying. But I think it's something to experience now, and then it's enhanced and fuller in heaven. But I don't think it's all something we just wait for. That's one of the reasons why we sing, because we have something to celebrate now. Here's another question. Does it mean if you dutifully follow God, you won't be happy? Yes, it definitely means that. If your following of God is done by duty, you won't be happy. But I presume you already know that, because if you're doing that, you will have discovered that to be true. Duty alone is an inadequate relationship. It's inadequate in any relationship. If we change that to, if a husband loves his wife just dutifully, will they be happy? Will that be a happy marriage? No, of course it won't be. It'd be a terrible marriage. It'll still be a marriage, but it'll just be a terrible marriage. Next question. How should we try to contribute to the happiness of others? That's a really good question. I don't think it's at all... Is it addressed in this story? Well, maybe it is. I imagine the younger son upping and offing would have broken his father's heart, the breakdown in that relationship. I suspect, therefore, it's very evident, isn't it, the joy of that son returning. So maybe that's one way we could do it. Recognize, coming to our senses, recognizing the breakdown in our relationship with others, accepting the responsibility we've had in that, saying sorry. I think the word sorry is probably the thing that contributes to the most happiness of other people, more than anything else, more than money, more than just saying sorry. Sorry, another doctor. Okay, this is picking up on the interview as well. David spoke of having joy but not happiness. How do you describe the difference between the two? I think that's a really good question. And I think happiness, I think the language David used was sort of surface level and deep. And I think sometimes the sort of surface level, the smile on the face, that kind of bubbling feeling, rising feeling of anticipation and excitement in our hearts, that's the kind of a happiness. And that often comes out of a relationship with God. It comes from lots of things. It comes from watching football. It comes from eating. It comes from, you know, lots of things can bring us that sense of excitement and enjoyment. But I think those things are triggered, but they can kind of come and go quite easily, even many times in a day. And I think the difference is, and I think this is what David was getting at, is there's something of significance going on at a deeper level that doesn't ebb and flow depending on circumstances, and endures despite everything going wrong and really hard times, and that is something that continues to exist. And I think David used the word a sort of contentment, and that is, I think, only possible if you have a restored relationship with God. Otherwise, your happiness will come and go depending on your life situation. Have we got time for one more? There are many more, but let me take one more. We've just had that one. What about people who think they can decide when to turn to God and enjoy the hedonism until then? Well, that's a very honest question, isn't it? How late can I leave it and still be okay? I think to answer that question is to totally misunderstand and the value of what you're turning to as opposed to what you're turning from. C.S. Lewis, the guy who wrote the Narnia stuff, and he wrote some wonderful, more explicitly Christian books, and he had a wonderful image of, I won't get it exactly right, but he described us as children who are content to make mud pies in a puddle, and that enjoyment that comes from making mud pies in a puddle, because we have no conception of what a day at the seaside looks like. And this seems fun if you don't know about that. But if you really understand what a day at the seaside is all about, you get up out of your mud puddle and you go. So I think I would want to say enjoying hedonism compared to a restored relationship with God, why settle for less? It's just a mud puddle. Not to say it's not fun. It just pales into insignificance. Okay, listen, if I didn't get to your question or you're one of the doctors who wrote ineligibly, do come and explain what the prescription said, and I will be happy to have a chat with you. I'm going to hand back to Dave.